You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Atheistically Speaking. This is episode 279 and I'm your host, Thomas Smith. All right, let's just get right back over to part two with the researchers who did the No Child Left Alone study. Really interesting stuff. People had some comments. I think a lot of the comments may actually be answered in part two. So I'll give you part two and then we'll see where we are from there. I guess maybe I'm a little more worried than you that this the evidence is great and the study is great, but how much are people going to listen to evidence and studies, you know? Are you worried that we won't be, and to be honest, this really is the reason I wanted to have you guys on, because this seems like a gigantic issue to me. Like, it's not, I really don't want to leave my kid in the car for 5 minutes and get arrested. Like, it really should concern everybody. But at the same time, I mean, there are still all kinds of phobias people have that data hasn't really impacted, you know, and do you worry that it won't be
enough?
It's
almost the definition of a phobia, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, exactly.
It's like it's impervious to data.
Right.
So for example, a lot of my peers now that I know are afraid to leave their kids alone, not because they think anything will happen to the kids, but because they're afraid that somebody will call the cops.
Right.
And that's, I don't think that's a phobia because it's relatively common.
Yeah, so, that's not, yeah, certainly.
I mean, it's not actually an unrealistic fear. My hope is in, let me see, a couple of things. There's a strong libertarian tradition in the U.S. There's a tradition of people saying, you know, parents should be able to make decisions for their kids and the law should not get involved unless there's real demonstrable, statistically significant, not just statistically significant, but practically significant danger.
Yeah.
And so that's one argument that can be made that I think gets a lot of traction. Also, there are people who pride themselves on making decisions rationally. And among them, I hope, are judges and people who make laws and policies. That if we can put data, well-documented, clear arguments out there that say this doesn't make sense and it's not supported by data, maybe people who consider it their job to make decisions based on data will listen. So that I don't have much hope that people will stop taking videos of somebody who walks. You know, there was a thing last week where this couple went to a restaurant, strapped their baby into the baby seat at the table, and then got up and walked 6 feet away to the buffet to get their food. And some guy at the next table took video of it and posted it on Facebook saying, "These horrible people abandoned their child." Like, yeah, they walked 6 feet away. And it got like 4 million views on Facebook. And Facebook is, you know, it got huge, you know, the comments are just, you know, really hateful and like, these horrible people should be locked up.
I just love, that's what's so ridiculous to me. People's view of what criminals are doing, like criminal child predators, they go to restaurants, and they order food, and then they sit there and they wait. They wait
they
for
wait
you
to
walk,
until
six,
you
feet
walk
away.
6 feet away.
And they're just ready. Chance. Yeah, exactly. And they're wearing running shoes, and they just, you see, they just run and they bolt. Yeah, like,
and they're gonna be at least 6 feet ahead of you. Yeah. At least six foot lead, and that's enough.
And it's the same thing. Like I let's see, I went to the bank the other day and it's so hot. I guess we're all in California, but it's so hot where I am that I just left the car running so that I could keep the AC going. It's only going to be a minute, you know, and apologies for the environmental impact there. But my wife reacted like, you just left the keys in the car and you left the car running while you're at the ATM. And I said, yeah, I don't think car thieves are roaming parking lots, like just waiting for the perfect opportunity. You can't see that a car is running, really. I mean, it's kind of hard, especially newer cars.
No, I mean, it seems like the kind of decision we all make every day, right?
Yeah,
You, like when I I walked here. I live pretty close to my office, so I walked here. So yeah, I took on some risks, right? There could be snipers on the building roofs. There could be muggers.
It happened in the '60s, right? Or whatever.
Yeah. I could be raped and murdered and shot. There was a professor at UCLA who was shot by a student and killed, right? The student was unhappy with his grade, but yet
you still give your students bad grades. Yeah.
We come to class, you know, we come to work. I walk to work. Like there are some risks that even though they're not zero, they're so small that it would be crazy to act like they were likely to happen. So you don't, every time you walk into a grocery store, you don't make an escape plan for if terrorists bomb the grocery store while you're in there. Or if there's there are shootings in movie theaters, but I still go to the movies. I understand that there's not a zero chance that there could be a mass shooting in the movie theater while I'm in there. The chance is not zero, but the chance is very, very low. And so I don't plan my day around it, you know?
Yeah, apportioning your fears to the data is probably the best idea. But
that actually gets to the point you were starting with. I mean, maybe it is too much to hope that, you know, we can change hearts and minds across the spectrum of everybody. But it would be satisfying enough if you could get the legal system to stop relying on intuitions that are demonstrably unreliable. And in a way, we don't know if that's possible yet or not. To this point, right, people, judges, cops, nobody's had a reason to question the reliability of their own intuitions about when kids
actually, I was going to ask, did you look at like the kinds of laws that are allowing this to happen? Is it that they're worded so vaguely as to allow for any?
In most cases, they're worded to say, like, if a child. So there's a couple of cases. There are cases where the laws would not seem to apply, but people apply them anyway. So like the story we started talking about where the woman let a 4-year-old wait in the car for 5 minutes and she's charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. That looks to me like a case where they just couldn't find anything to actually charge her with. So they made something up.
But the whole town knew she was guilty. So they just found something. Yeah.
Exactly. And then the Mateev case in Maryland, you know, the law in Maryland actually said that children under 8 or something are not allowed to be locked in a car or a building or an enclosure alone for some period of time. And these kids were walking on the street. So it doesn't seem like it should apply at all. But it didn't stop Child Protective Services from picking up the kids twice. It didn't stop the cops from picking them up. So there are cases where the law it's not against the law, but people are so sure that something must be terribly wrong with it that they're trying to apply laws. And then there are other cases where the law is just vague. So it just says, if the police officer thinks the child is in danger, then he or she can take the child. If the caseworker thinks the child is in danger, they can remove the kids. So there's definitely the policies in many cases are written in such a way as to trust the judgment and intuitions of people like police officers and social workers and judges. And that's a problem if their intuitions are demonstrably biased, as we've shown. And unfortunately, two depressing things that cognitive science has shown is not only that people's decision-making is systematically biased, but that people are systematically confident about their decisions. So even if you say to people, you know, your decision-making is biased in this way, they don't want to believe it, right? So they really think that we all really believe that we're good at making decisions and that our decisions are not biased.
Yeah. If you give people the evidence on the dangers of driving while being on a cell phone, for example, they will come to believe that other people's driving is very badly affected by their cell phone use. But they don't believe that about themselves.
Right. How much did you look at just the role that social media plays in your feedback loop? Because I can imagine that perhaps that's a giant factor. Because let's picture the same feedback loop, but without social media, people just call the police and there's a baby in a car, whatever it is. And they get a bit of a warm feeling because they're like, okay, I did the right thing. But now magnify that times a billion, because now you put the video on, you're a hero, you get to be this moral figure for like saving this child or saving this dog. There's a lot of those videos. Did you look at that at all? Is there anything interesting to say about that?
We didn't look at the role of social media. I think it's a really interesting question. It's another certainly candidate for why this could be spiraling as quickly as it is. But we didn't have anything to say about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Notice It doesn't need to be nearly that fancy for something like social media to play a big role here. What's important here is that people are making a moral judgment,
mm-hmm.
and they're reinforced in that moral judgment by how many other people
share it
and jump on.
It's like an accelerator. It already takes the problem you've outlined, and it just kind of magnifies it even more.
That's right. Given that other people agree with them, oh yes, that was a terrible thing for that mother to do.
Right.
They are reassured and more confident that their, you know, base gut instincts about what's acceptable and what isn't, or what's dangerous and what isn't, are correct. And that there's just a lot more of that reinforcement going on, given the existence of social media, right? Given how much more connected people are.
It's interesting with the social media case too. And I don't like to read the comments in those things because they're so awful, but I don't get a lot of sense of concern for the baby, right? People are not posting these things and saying, oh my gosh, was the baby okay? I mean, the baby is quite obviously okay. Yeah. Like the baby is sitting.
The baby's always okay.
High chair, fine. What you get is a lot of anger at the parents, particularly the mothers, right? You get a lot of like really nasty language about the mother. Or the parents, or
About that. There's a difference in status of, I guess, demographics of how they responded to the questions. You want to go into that a little bit? The groups that responded one way versus another.
Sure. One of the things we asked people, we asked them, the people who filled out the survey, and there were a total of, I think we ended up with 1,501 or something people, and across all the studies. We asked them a bunch of questions about themselves. So we asked their age, sex, whether they had kids or not, racial or ethnic identity, how many years of education they had. I think that was it. And the only of those demographic variables, the only two that made a difference were whether they were male or female and whether they had kids or not. And so what we found was that women and the effect. It wasn't a difference in the effect. Everybody showed the effect. That is, everybody's judgments were biased by their moral. Everybody's risk assessments were biased by their moral judgments.
Mm-hmm.
But what we saw a difference in was the absolute risk assessments that people made. So how dangerous they thought it was. Women gave higher risk estimates than men. And people with children gave higher risk estimates than people without children. So if you put those two factors together, what you get is that mothers make the highest risk estimates, followed by fathers, followed by childless women, and then childless men. So it was the same pattern of behavior across all the groups, but the absolute kind of amount of overestimation of risk was affected by those things.
You might also be thinking, though, Thomas, about the difference that we found when we made the parent who was leaving the child a father rather than a mother.
Oh, that too. Yeah. That's interesting to talk about as well.
So that's not the demographics of the subject pool.
No, I was actually talking about the single. I was going to say, because I'm a childless dude, that I could be one reason.
That's right.
You
don't care. You're not afraid.
I don't care. Yeah.
actually, this is a striking feature of the study too. The differences Barbara just sketched emerged, but it's also true that across the board, people's risk estimates were incredibly high.
Yeah.
Right? We gave them a scale from 1 to 10. We wound up shortening the amount of time that kids were alone, because when we had longer times, you couldn't get anybody to say anything except that all the kids were about to die immediately. And it was still the case that on our the average risk estimate to children left alone.
The modal.
The average is about 7.
Right.
And
sorry.
The most common answer to how much danger a child was in any of these situations was 10. 10 out of 10.
Oh, wow.
There's nothing more dangerous.
I hope this isn't a dumb question, but is it possible? Could it have been worded in a way that wasn't like how much danger, and therefore your mind goes to danger? Do you think that could have made any difference? Like if it was like how safe are they?
We used both. We said on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being the safest / least dangerous, and 10 being the least safe slash most dangerous. So we use the word safe and dangerous or risky in both.
Okay. And it didn't make any difference.
It didn't seem to matter.
Right. Okay.
Didn't matter.
Sorry, I interrupted you, Kyle. Go ahead, Nate.
That's okay. Let me just quickly get back to the fathers versus mothers thing. So right there, it's not the demographics of the subject pool, but we asked people, in one of our studies, we gave all the same vignettes, same amount of time, left alone, same reasons, but made the parent who was leaving the child alone a father rather than a mother. Found the same effect, right? The same thing happens. We replicated it again with one kind of intriguing difference. And that difference is this, right? So in other studies or the other replications, right, people found intentional absences to be much more dangerous than unintentional absences, right? But there wasn't any difference among the different unintentional absences except for the illicit affair, right? That was more dangerous than leaving to work, leaving to volunteer, or leaving to exercise or relax. But with fathers, that wasn't true. There's a little bit of a difference. A father's work-related absence was not seen as any more dangerous to the child than an unintentional absence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an effect we haven't replicated yet. We're hesitant to put too much weight on it, but it's suggestive, right? One possibility that it's suggestive of course, is that work is viewed more obligatory for fathers than mothers.
Yeah.
And so they are, to a certain extent, making less of a choice when they leave a child alone to go work. So it's certainly not the only possibility, right? But it's for those kinds of reasons that the finding is suggestive. It seems that there may well be a double standard.
Right. Yeah. It certainly sounds like it could be some sort of sexism, like the female has more of a responsibility. And so therefore you make more of a moral judgment maybe. Yeah. Interesting. Let's talk about maybe another reason why this matters so much is the fact that constant supervision may have bad effects. Do you want to talk about that, Barbara?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that one of the things that people do when they think through these scenarios is they have this kind of conversation with themselves where they say, should I, so take the example I gave you before where I'm deciding whether to let the 7-year-old stay on the couch and watch TV or thinking, do I force him to come along with me to pick up the 1-year-old? And I think people sometimes have this thought process where they say, well, I know the chances of anything terrible happening while he's here alone are low, but what does it hurt to just bring him along? I mean, I'll just be on the safe side. There's no cost to bringing him along. It's a little bit inconvenient for me, but at least, you know, X, whatever horrible low frequency thing won't happen. And there's no harm done if I bring him and it doesn't, you know, there's no chance of a bad thing happening if I bring him. So I think that's wrong, right? I think that, we need to start talking about what is lost when children are never allowed any independence or any responsibility. And I say this as a developmental psychologist. Like, it's not only that by taking the child along, I would have subjected him to the risk of a car accident, which is much higher than the risk of, you know, something terrible befalling him while he sat on the couch watching TV. But it's also that, you know, it was appropriate. It was age appropriate. It was developmentally appropriate for us to have a conversation about whether he was old enough to be alone and what things he needed to do to make sure that he was safe and what kind of responsibility it involved. And like, you're not going to play with matches and you're not going to use knives and you're not going to yada, yada, yada. And if you do all these things right and you show me that you can be responsible, then maybe I'll let you stay alone another time for 25 minutes instead of 20 minutes, right? Like, that's appropriate. And it's good for kids' development. I think it was good for him. He was proud of himself. He felt responsible and grown up.
Yeah.
And anyway, if I had never done that, what would the end game be? Like, he's 17 now. He's going to move out next year. Like,
well, you're going to have to go to college with him. And you're gonna,
exactly. Yeah. Like sooner or later, right? Your kids are not dogs.
You can't be in a dorm room forever by himself. That won't work.
You can't, yeah, you have to turn them into adults, right? That's the job as parents, is that like you gradually let them turn into humans who can live on their own without you. And if there's sort of hysterical, paranoid obsession with never ever letting them be subjected to a couple of very tiny risks, and no thought given to like their need to develop responsibility and good judgment and independence on their own, then I think that's being lost, right, in this conversation. That there's all this focus on the kid's going to be abducted by a stranger, and no focus on what are the psychological implications of being raised as though you're in, you know, Aleppo or something.
You know, I it's so interesting, and I don't think anyone stated it explicitly. What is the actual risk? Because I think you had the numbers of your child being abducted.
Right.
Yeah.
So Daniel Gardner estimates it at 1 in 1.4 million annually. But there's a British author who, you know, 1.4 million is kind of hard to understand. But if you break that down to the risk of any given child, there was a British author who tried to estimate if you wanted your child to be abducted for some reason, how long would you have to leave them outside?
Yeah, that's good info.
In order to make it statistically
okay.
likely. And
good info for unhappy parents. Yeah.
Indeed. Do you want to take a guess? What?
How long of just with, time alone?
Yeah, how long would you
alone?
Have to leave a kid outside in a, I believe it was the average British suburb to make it likely that they would be abducted.
Does it matter where it is, because the British population versus the, so was that one out of one something million of British?
It was a number of, no, the one out of 1.4 million was America. But what you have to do is then you have to know the number of children in America.
I may not be able to do this in my head. So I'll just guess.
He came up with something like, go ahead.
I will guess, just to do a terrible calculation. Let's guess 50 years.
He came up with 600,000 years. So,
come on, get on it, criminals. Jeez, lazy.
You have to you have to know the population of kids in the country, the incidence of stranger abduction, the, you know, amount of the number of hours that they spend outside, the crime rate, you know, it's actually hard to quantify exactly what it is. But it's a tiny, tiny.
He's not accounting for the buzz that this would create in the child, you know, kidnapping community. They'd be like, "Did
abducting
you see this kid?
Community?"
Yeah, yeah. This kid every day he's there. He just sits there. He's just waiting to be taken.
Yeah. So if you look at the odds for any individual child, it's crazy. Like, yeah, I mean, they would not be a child long before the chances would be that would be anything
that's
like.
That's
high
a good that point. All you have to do is get to adulthood. You just have to get that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, anything more than like 10 years is irrelevant, right? Because they're not a child anymore.
Yeah.
So the kind of variables, like, you know, what the location is and what the crime rate is there and stuff like that, all of those things certainly matter to the answer to the question, what was the actual risk for this person in this environment? But across the board, no matter what those statistics are like, it's going to be tiny. It's going to be tiny compared to risks that people are ignoring when they instead take the kid with them in a car or whatever, right? So it can't be the case that some people are really reacting to having a reasonable reaction to their circumstances and then other people aren't, right? Nobody who has this attitude has it because they have good objective evidence that at least around here, kids get abducted all the time, right? That's right. Not true anywhere.
That's true.
You know, I'm wondering, just random question. Why do you think people are so, it must be something else going on, but people minimize the car auto accident risk, it seems like. But because when you look at the availability heuristic, I mean, it's not like we don't see auto accidents in the news every day. I mean, I said certainly every day there's a car accident.
They don't even make the news a lot of the time. Exactly. I know them because they're not even newsworthy.
Right.
You probably know because you've been in a few of them or you've had friends who have been in auto accidents.
Well, if you want to flip on the news around commute time, you're always going to see an auto accident. That's the reason why. And I wonder, is it just a question of we just need to drive, so we decide, whatever. But like, we don't necessarily need to fly in a plane every day, so then we look at it as like this other thing. I was just wondering if you have any thoughts on that, because it's interesting that through all this, we minimize the car risk, like driving
Absolutely.
The kid away, you know.
Yeah. I think it might be related to what Kyle was talking about earlier when he said, you know, hopefully Kyle was saying people get evidence that children don't burst into flames the minute you look away, right? People look away and the children don't burst into flames. And I was thinking when you were saying that, Kyle, like, well, actually, people don't get as much evidence of that as they once did, because if you refuse to ever leave your child alone, you can continue to believe that if you ever left your child alone, the child would burst into flames, right?
Right.
So in a sense, they're they're denying themselves the opportunity to gather the evidence that this is not actually as dangerous as it seems. But with car journeys, people get that evidence all the time.
Yeah.
You know, they can hear about, basically people are terrible at thinking about statistics, and statistical arguments about how rare something is just don't penetrate people's reasoning very well at all. And so you can talk about the odds of a car crash, but what people think in a car crash is, you know, about, they think about car crashes, they think, well, I drive every day and I'm fine. You know, I've been driving for years and I'm fine. Well, there was that one accident 5 years ago, but I've driven every day since then and I'm fine. And I think this is what people used to think when kids were routinely spending a lot of time on their own. They would hear about some terrible thing and it would traumatize them. But on the other hand, their kid and all the other kids in the neighborhood were outside every day and nothing was happening and it was clearly fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
The other thing. So when, I think that really matters that people have all this other evidence that, you know, they're not going to, they don't wreck every time they take their car out and stuff like that. There, it does seem to me there's also likely to be some element here of seeming like more of a choice. Right. So if you say, right, it's not a practical possibility to not ever drive around with the kids.
Right.
And if you say to someone, well, you know, you realize you're subjecting them to this small but not zero risk of dying by driving them to school, people's natural reaction is like, well, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah. Right? Do they just put it in their minds as like part of the background risk of being a human? They just say, this is a necessity.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of change in what we're treating as the background, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a generation ago, you know, it would seem ridiculous for someone to say to someone else, well, you realize that you're exposing your children to a non-zero risk of being abducted if you let them play out by themselves at the park or in the backyard or whatever it is. The naturalness of doing that, the frequency, the how common it is for parents to do that, that doesn't seem like a reasonable reaction to the risk. And they were right a generation ago. It's not. Now we've got the moral reinforcement of these beliefs about risk. The scenarios we gave, all the voluntary ones, very much seemed like a choice. You were choosing to subject your child to a risk that marked you as a bad parent or something like that, right? Whereas they don't think of, they're inclined to think of driving the kids around as something you have to do. Mm-hmm. There's no way, other way you're going to get them to do stuff you need to do. Of course you could.
An example of that, Kyle, an example of the background changing, a friend of mine was telling me the other day that, so my friend is in her 50s. She has, she was telling me about a friend of hers who is a man in his maybe 60s now. His parents were Holocaust survivors.
Oh.
And he grew up in New York City, and his mom and, you know, the other moms of the kids he knew, a lot of them had survived the Holocaust, right? And they were traumatized. And when the kids would walk to school, the parents, the moms would call each other and say, they've walked past this apartment. They're okay. Mm. You know, and they'd walk past the next apartment and the next mom would call and say, okay, they've walked past this apartment. You know, they've walked past my apartment. They're okay. It sounds kind of crazy in two ways. Like in one way, it sounds understandably crazy because if you've been through some horrific event where many of your family members have been killed, then you can understand being so traumatized that you would, you know, be just terrified for your child's safety. But also they let them walk to school.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Today, where none of these parents of young children could possibly be a Holocaust survivor. they're acting more traumatized than people who actually did survive the Holocaust, right? They're not letting their kids walk to school because they think it's too dangerous.
Well, I assume if they had time to talk on the phone, they could have just walked with them, right? So like they're
yeah, theoretically. But I think at that time, I mean, I was wondering, like, why didn't they just, you know, walk with them? But probably the kids would have said, Mom, geez, don't embarrass me. Like all the kids are walking to school alone. Leave me alone. You know, they were kind of doing what the culture did, which was let the kids walk to school.
Right. Makes sense. So as culture changes, it sort of goes, it fades into our background assessment of risk that we always just have to put up with. Interesting.
What risks are reasonable. It's actually the point about the Holocaust surviving, the hypothetical Holocaust surviving parent is connected to the thing we were saying about the demographic differences, right? I think we were surprised, right? So you might think parents would be more relaxed about this than non-parents because they know more. They have way more evidence of, right, what actually happens to kids when you do this or do that or do the other thing. The fact that it's the opposite way is actually another reason to believe that what's going on here is moral judgments are inflating estimates of risk to children. Because the people who are in a better position to know that those risks are overblown are the people who judge most harshly. And so it suggests that, right, that's another reason to think it's so. Why would it be more there? Well, people who are parents are more willing to morally judge other people's parenting. Right. And so.
Or maybe they're more aware. They're more aware of the norm.
Yeah, I was going to say I can imagine that going either way.
That's also possible.
Yeah,
that's also possible. Yeah. But it's not that how much this affects you depends on how much evidence you have about kids, right? That doesn't seem to be.
I was really surprised by that because as a mom, I thought, come on, anybody who thinks that you're going to raise kids without ever leaving them out of your sight for a second has not tried to raise kids. That's just ridiculous. And I thought anybody who has kids understands that it's life doesn't work that way. You can't stare at them every minute and still, get the groceries bought and make their dinner and, walk the dog and whatever. But I was wrong. Yeah. I was wrong. Mothers
wrong
were more
were
panicked
reasonable.
And hysterical.
Yeah, that is,
and judgmental.
That's really interesting. I would love to know more about why that is for sure. It's like they're, like Kyle was saying, I suppose, is that still in the theory phase? Or you still just have a number of different ideas about why that might be? Or do you think you have a good explanation for
that? Yeah, we don't know why. I mean, we see the effects, but we haven't tested any hypotheses about why.
Yeah, because it really seems like it could go either way. I think your intuition makes sense that once you experience the reality of trying to raise kids, you're like, well, there's no way I'm going to watch this kid every second. It's impossible. But man, it's weird. It's like becoming a parent. You take on those judgments more all of a sudden, like you're in that world more. So you, it's really interesting.
And I think actually that I think there's a quality of superstition about it in the sense that there are lots of superstitious practices that are designed to protect you from horrible things. So like you're going to throw salt over your left shoulder and it's going to keep the devil away or something. And I think this idea, you're a parent, you have a kid, you contemplate this horrific nightmarish scenario where someone kidnaps and rapes and murders your child. And it's so awful that psychologically you have to protect yourself from it. So you start thinking, well, it'll never happen to me because I will do blank, right? So you kind of make this bargain where you say like, I will do this thing. And if, as long as I do this thing, the terrible thing will never happen to my kid. And I think that the bargain that has been sort of widely accepted is that if you never let your kid out of your sight, then nothing bad will ever happen to them. And that would explain why mothers and fathers were more subject to it than non-parents, right? Because they have more investment in believing that this magical formula works. Like if you never stop looking at the child, then no bad thing will ever happen. And of course, most of the bad things that happen to kids have nothing to do with parental supervision. Like, kids die from diseases that they would not get, childhood obesity is really up in recent years, right? If kids were spending hours and hours playing outside, like they did a generation ago, they would have, be said to have a longer lifespan than their parents instead of a shorter lifespan for the first time in history. So there's all, most of the bad things that are going to happen to your kid have nothing to do with you watching them or not watching them. Things like juvenile type 2 diabetes and heart disease and cancer and car accidents and...
Well, and it's like that stat, it might have been a Freakonomics thing or something, like you should be far more worried about your pool than having a gun in the house or something like that, where people just are not able to align their fears with the stats.
Yeah. Another thing that's interesting is if you look at the actual accident, the most common accidental deaths are all things that really can't happen to a baby or a toddler who's strapped into a car seat, for example. So people are very freaked out about babies being in cars, but the most common causes of accidental deaths are, first of all, car accidents, but then I think in order it's drowning and then fires and falls and poisoning. So a baby strapped into a car seat can't drown or start a fire or fall down or be poisoned, right? Yeah. Like the baby is basically protected from all the bad things.
Yeah. That's a good point.
I mean, babies are actually more at risk from congenital birth defects. That's why babies die the most.
Well, you have to watch them, otherwise they'll develop a birth defect.
They really develop those. That's right.
The, that old saying, the watched baby never develops it. Yeah.
Spina bifida.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kyle. You have something to chat
about? Well, I was just going to say that this is, I mean, in a way, this is part of why it's so important for understanding the situation we're in, that there's a norm now, right, in place. Because that's part of what, right, that's what makes it seem like part of the background or not, right?
Yeah.
There's, because we've entrenched this norm that you don't leave children alone, that's what starts people thinking, but I would like to leave this child alone in this set of circumstances and I think it's safe, but what if something happened, right? I would blame myself, right? It makes an enormous difference for there to be a norm that you are violating.
Right.
By doing this thing that people broadly have the attitude you should not do.
Right. So you should think, if it happened, you should think, wow, that was unfortunate. But since you're looking at it as a norm, you're thinking, I did this wrong and therefore I brought this on.
I couldn't live with myself if something did happen. So I'll bring her along with me, even though I know the chances are low.
I was doing research on weird causes of death, and apparently 450 Americans a year die from falling out of bed. And they're mostly old people or little kids. And I started thinking about it and, you know, my older son has fallen out of bed twice that I can remember. He had a bed with a railing on it in our house, but then we were in a hotel once, we were on a trip and he fell out of the hotel bed and he actually smacked his face on the bedside table. And he has a scar on his chin that he'll probably have forever. And it never, I didn't beat myself up. I didn't think like, oh my God, I let him sleep in this bed.
You should have roped him in. Like, you should have,
how could I have done that?
Why didn't you buy the new bed harness that harnesses your,
Because it's a social, like it's normal to let your kid sleep in a bed, right? So I didn't feel like I had to beat myself up about it.
That makes sense.
Whereas I suppose if when he was left at that park alone, if he had somehow fallen on something and gotten a scar on his chin, everybody would be like, see, that's why you don't leave him at a park alone.
Yeah. Well, we're getting a little low on time, I'd say. So in closing, I suppose I would just say I did find this very interesting for the reasons I stated before. And I'm willing to be a test case for maybe the Supreme Court or something. I'll have a kid and I'm just going to leave him or her everywhere. And
then one last thought I have is that I don't want, I wouldn't want people to hear about this issue and think, oh my God, I have to stop. You know, if to whatever degree people are giving their children a little bit of independence, I wouldn't want them to hear this podcast and then be like, that's it. No more walking to school. You know, I just found out that, people get arrested all the time. I think it would be really unfortunate if the effect of this study was to raise people's awareness of the hysteria and make them feel like they had to conform to it because they, you know, like I didn't realize that the cops were being called.
That there's a norm.
So I would say, if you're letting your kids walk to school, bravo, you know, stand tall. Our research supports you making rational decisions, even if everybody around you thinks you're crazy, because you're not crazy. And also, I would say, this is a small thing, but we keep talking about children being alone. They're not necessarily alone just because there's no adult there. A generation ago, kids were walking to school in groups. They were playing in parks with a lot of other kids, right? The kids in the neighborhood would play on the street, in the park, in the neighborhood. They would walk to school. And so sometimes I feel like this conversation falls into the trap of thinking that you're either a mother and a child or a father and a child alone or a child alone, like the child sitting there alone. That's just because an adult is around doesn't mean the kids are alone, right? They could be with other kids.
Yeah, yeah.
One other point that's worth making. I mean, in talking about an issue like this, I think it is important to recognize that child endangerment is real. People do things that are incredibly stupid and that put their kids at danger or in danger. And really what we're supporting is, so we're not saying, stop worrying about kids, right? In any circumstance, it's that you should only be worried when there's real evidence of a danger.
Yeah.
And there isn't real evidence of a danger across so many circumstances where parents assume there is
And as we were saying before, cops and DAs and judges trust their gut intuitions about whether a child is in danger or not. And so in a way, right, we're not trying to get everybody to ignore their kids more so much as we're trying to get people to apportion their actions to the evidence of actual risks.
Right, exactly.
And that's what seems to be missing.
All right. Well said. And I want to give you one more big thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Professor Barbara Czarnecka, Professor Kyle Stanford, thank you so much. And I mean it, Kyle, when you finish your paper, I would love to hear more about it. That's another area of interest for me, moral philosophy.
Thanks a lot, Thomas. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you guys so much. Right. Thanks again so much to my guests. And I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Now, there were a few people who, I don't know, maybe weren't on board with the entire concept initially. Now, of course, I'm recording this part early, so I'll see what the full reaction is once I've heard from everybody. Please comment wherever you want if you want your opinion heard, and maybe I'll read it on the show at some point. But I'm just extremely interested in these situations because, like I said to start all of this, and I'm sure like was mentioned throughout the show, I mean, this could happen to any of us as a parent. We could make a decision. Just imagine the principle of making a decision that you know is entirely in your child's best interest. Now, let's say you have two choices. One is to leave them in a nice, cool car, secured in a car seat or something where you know, nothing, they're not going to get too hot, they're not going to fall, they're not going to start the car, nothing like that. Or let's say you have to walk them through a dangerous situation, like through a parking lot, or keep them somewhere where you're not sure you're going to be able to keep an eye on them, like you're trying to do some shopping, something like that. Or just driving them somewhere, like actual alternatives where you know that the science, the data tells you you are doing the safer thing, but society tells you you're a monster because you left your kid alone for a few minutes, even though nothing is going to happen. Like, odds are, it's not that it's not impossible, it's that just overwhelmingly, the odds are nothing is going to happen. And as someone who grew up in the country where we just were outside all day, I mean, I suppose we weren't alone. We were alone quite a bit, and we were, me and my siblings, we would be left in the car for hours at a time. It's just nobody cared back then. And I know it's anecdotal to say, oh, nothing ever happened to me and I'm fine, except that the data shows that nothing ever happened to any of us except, you know, one or two. And for the most part, it's an outlier that seems more likely than it is. And for that reason, for me, like, I don't have kids yet, but I can imagine that being incredibly traumatic, frustrating, it's so many feelings, really bitter feelings when I think of what would happen, what my reaction would be if the police or child services was called on me when I was doing something I knew the data proves is correct. Now that would be really difficult for me to handle. I don't know how I would, that's a situation where I don't know how I would handle that. And I'm really hoping that studies like these and maybe others will bring us more towards sanity on all this stuff. So I'm really happy to have had these guests, and I hope to do more like this in the future. I think getting awareness of actual good science is important out there. It's something I want to do with the show. So thank you so much for listening. That's all I have for you today. I want to thank my wonderful production assistant, Haley, for setting up that conversation and for setting up the one that's going to be the next episode and likely most future episodes. Going to be very interesting stuff, and I hope you'll enjoy it. All right, I'll see you then.